From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
This is MC Fontaine welcoming you to another Bletchley Park podcast extra. In the last episode, we gave you a small excerpt of Martin Davidson's talk that he gave at Bletchley Park about the book he's written tracing the history of his grandfather. So over the next two extras episodes, we'll be bringing you the entire talk and discovering the perfect Nazi.
Please welcome Martin Davidson.
Well, thank you so much for coming out. First of all, just to say thank you for coming in the middle of a freezing cold January night. I applaud your tenacity and your commitment to history. I feel particularly honoured to be doing this at Bletchley Park. My day job is I'm a commissioner for history television at the BBC, and we have the huge pleasure of commissioning and making a film about Bletchley Park went out last year called The Codebreakers of Bletchley Park, which told the story of Bill Tutt and Tommy Flowers, and it was a wonderful, wonderful film, and I can't commend it enough to you if you haven't seen it. Brilliant local guys explaining with chalk how all those calculations work that Colossus was based on. Don't ask me to recount it. I was stupefied. There's a great line that Byron wrote in Don Juan about German philosophy, and he was describing Coleridge. Coleridge spends his day explaining metaphysics to the nation. Now I wish he'd explain his explanation. And I think that's what I felt there. But I feel suitably awed to be at a location that perhaps more than any other in Britain helped ensure that a man like my grandfather remained a defeated footnote, rather than, as he very, very, very much pledged his life to becoming, a master of Europe. Part of my grandfather's story was that he had a role to play in German security. He was in the Sicherheitsdienst, the SD. And there was just a bit of, to quote another great German word, Schadenfreude, I would have had to have been able to at one point explain to him how all his efforts were completely in vain because of Ultra and Enigma and Turing and all the extraordinary work that was done here. And I wish I'd known about it and he'd lived long enough just to have enjoyed that moment. This is, I think, an unusual book. Unusual in the sense that there are books written in Germany by Germans who realised that they had a certain rather black sheep in their families. I think I'm the only person who's British to have done it. There is a difference. It's interesting. I think it was a book you could only have written in the way I wrote it, looking at it from the point of view, not of the German experience, but the British experience. In my case, rather complicated by the fact that I have a German mother and therefore half a German family. But also, I think it was a book that was impossible to write except by the second generation. I think it would have been very difficult for my mother and her generation to write it. I think they were just too close. And I think there's a sort of distance you have as a grandchild. I think any more generations and it just becomes history. I think what was key to me in writing this book was that I actually knew the man. He lived. He survived. I mean, he went through that whole crucible of World War II, escaped with his life by the skin of his teeth, escaped prosecution by the skin of his teeth, and lived to the final age of, I think he was in his mid-80s when he finally died in 1992, a lot longer than many of the people his regime brushed up against. And he had the amazing fortune to die quietly in his bed in Berlin at a ripe old age. That does make a difference. I didn't know him intimately. We would meet. There was always a certain caginess around. I did go to Berlin, where he lived, pretty much every year in the summer through the 60s and 70s. So he was there. He was a fixture of those visits to Berlin, a very formidable character. And when I later, after he died, discovered what he'd been, there was a sense in which what I was trying to do was create the curriculum vitae of a man who I could picture. Now, I pictured him as an old man. I never, obviously never knew him, as it were, in his prime. But it is an interesting exercise to have in your mind's eye the living memory of a man who, it turns out, was a fire-breathing, lifelong, utterly committed Nazi. It's quite an unnerving experience. I would also say, when I finished writing this book, there was a bit of me that felt certainly a bit of catharsis, but this stuff having in your head is not nice. It is very, very toxic, because what I tried very hard to do was get under his skin, try and find out what on earth explanation is there possibly there to be gleaned for why these people did what they did. So one of the assumptions I decided to work to in telling his story was I gave him one benefit of the doubt. I decided that every decision Bruno made in his life, born in 1906, died in 1992, that every one of his decisions I would give the benefit of the doubt to as being conscious, rational, emphatic, and done in the full consciousness of what it meant. This is not the story of somebody who is hypnotized, seduced, a psychopath, a man operating entirely out of opportunism, which is the story which applies to a lot of Germans in this period. This is actually a much more worrying story. This is the man, not a stupid man, but he was neither unemployed nor a thug, who from an appallingly early age, from about, I'd say, his mid-teens in the early 20s, heard all this right-wing nationalist ideology that would become National Socialism and really liked the sound of it. Liked the sound of it so much that he pledged every one of his faculties, all of his kind of commitment, he invested it all in doing his part to make sure it would realise its vision. What I thought I'd do is I'm going to do a short reading to help sort of set the scene. There's a photograph of Bruno Lunkbein, my grandfather, dated 1931. It shows him tall, gangly, too young yet to have filled out into the commanding figure he later became. His wife, my grandmother, stands next to him. They're both looking into the sun, slightly uncertain, wishing to please. He is a Monsieur Hulot figure on the way to play that famous game of tennis in Jacques Tati's film. This is not, you feel, the man whose sheer force of personality later announced itself the minute he entered a room. Nor, would I suggest, it looks like a man who has a huge role to play in history. But compare it with the family portrait taken in July 1941, 10 years later. It was a photograph I had seen many times, lurking hidden in a family photo album at home, but I had never, as a child, ever identified the uniform, as it was neither black nor sporting anywhere I could see the double flash symbol of the SS. I'd always assumed it was just some kind of generic army uniform. Only later would I find out differently. But even if Bruno's uniform is hard to identify, the way he wears it is not. This is a man exuding the conviction of the true believer. His wife, gazing into the middle distance with her eyes lit up, blonde hair gleaming in soft, tight Valkyrie waves, no longer remotely resembling the rather frumpy figure of 10 years before. But it is Bruno who has been most strikingly transformed. No hint of diffidence, no trace of doubt, ambiguity or hesitance. This is a man who could quell you with a glance. He radiates cold command. Tomorrow and the day after, you feel, really do belong to him. 10 years separate these two photographs, just one decade that turned the gaunt, rather gauche newlyweds into the chilly, beaming poster couple for the thousand-year Reich. One German had irrevocably become another, as surely as the nation itself had turned into something rather different. This is the master race as they saw themselves. And I knew when I discovered what he'd done and what the uniform really entailed that I would not rest until I'd found out who this man and his wife, my grandfather and grandmother, really were. So I set out to discover what he'd done. And what I had to go on was a clutch of papers that I gathered together from various archives and libraries and document centres, names, dates and forms. And together they produced a sobering and comprehensive picture of a Nazi career. One that touched on virtually every major juncture and watershed in the story of the Third Reich from its earliest days to its last. There was scarcely, I would discover, a Nazi institution that Bruno had not at one point or another experienced. He was a party member. He had joined the Jungbund, the part of the party for youngsters. The Frontbahn, the SA, the brown shirts, the SS, the guys in black, the SD, the SS security service. He was even a member of the German Labour Front. The world of Nazi medicine, a Nazi tourist association, strength through joy, Nazi civil administration, he was even a soldier in the Wehrmacht. And what I realised was that in all of these capacities, he was a man who would be drawn into every dimension of Nazi policy, from its ideology, its politics, its ideas about welfare, its ideas about race, especially the Jewish question, and it would be a Nazi career that would culminate in war, from the early heady days of easy triumphs in France to the last-ditch battles on the collapsing Eastern Front. So over a single career, this man, my grandfather, I would discover, had worn three very different Nazi uniforms: SA Brown, SS Black, and Wehrmacht Field Grey. Professionally, he was a dentist, and he managed to combine dentistry, soldiering, espionage, policy implementation, and political street fighting, all in the service of the Third Reich, and a career that lasted pretty much the maximum period of time possible. Very few others his age could point to 22 years so actively engaged with the movement and across so broad a front. He'd been a stormtrooper, a street brawler, an ideologue, a policy intellectual, a biological warrior, a soldier, a spook, a bureaucrat. In short, the perfect Nazi. I spent the next 3 years joining all these dots. And the more I uncovered about him, the more I felt I needed to know. To see a Nazi story's archetypal as Bruno's acted out in the flesh, flesh I was directly related to, was both uncomfortable but in the end irresistible. By the end, I hope, of the process, two burning questions had been, if not fully answered, then at least decisively confronted. The first was a personal one. Bruno would no longer be the only member of the family who knew what he had done. It had been our deliberately encouraged ignorance that had allowed him to relish the notoriety of his Nazi career after the war, safe in the assumption he would never be called to account for it, and he had exploited that opportunity fully. I was glad that would no longer be the case, even if it had not been possible to confront him while still alive. The second was a wider point. The rise of Nazism had relied on men like Bruno more than I had ever realised before. For the first time in my life, I felt I'd been given a long, hard look at the face of National Socialism, at least in one of its most distinctive guises. My grandfather's story, so anonymous and ordinary in every other respect, might at least, I hoped, play one useful role as a cautionary tale, a living example of the harm even little men can achieve in times of historical madness. He was indeed the perfect Nazi, just not in the sense that he would have used the term. I will never know exactly what mixture of regret, or more likely bloody-minded pride, characterised his memories of that early life. But one thing I was certain about: the last word on the Third Reich belongs not to the perpetrators, but to those who came after, however limited our insights. They, in my mind, long ago forfeited the right to be the ones who get to draw a line in the sand. And I'm trying to offer a kind of reason for what I thought was the point of doing it, because on the one hand, Bruno Lampen is a man of no interest to anyone in this room. He's somebody's grandfather. But the thing that did intrigue me about him was, what did his life mean? What significance could I infer from his career that might shed light on what I think is a very interesting historical question, not just the personal one because it's my grandfather? And that is, I'm not a professional historian, but I've read very widely in this kind of subject matter. And it seems to me he belongs to a class of people in Germany in the story of the Third Reich that doesn't usually get explored by historians. And those are, if you like, the kind of inner core of 10,000 who were the blast furnace of commitment and conviction, who were the enablers. A lot of books we can read will give you biographies of the, if you like, the high table monsters: the Himmlers, the Heydrichs, the Goebbels, the Goerings. And there are lots of books that tell you, with varying degrees of credibility, what it was the wider German population did or did not know. But I became very interested in what Bruno was, which was a middle-ranking lever puller. He was the man who I thought would help answer one question that has always bothered me about the Nazi story. Because when you tell the story, when you do the biography of Hitler, the kind of stations of the cross on that story are very familiar. World War I, despair, poverty, starvation, political unrest, Treaty of Versailles, unfair, hyperinflation, the French invade the Ruhr Valley, Germany cannot believe it's lost a war it thought it was winning, because there was no war actually fought on Germany. It's not like 1945, when it was pretty obvious indeed that Germany had been the losing side of a war. 1929, 1933, all those points are very, very obvious. But what had never occurred to me was, why did all of that resentment about World War I and the Treaty of Versailles, which I absolutely appreciate, I don't find hard to understand at all why a generation of Germans should be so anguished and angry and disoriented and open to all sorts of extremist ideas in 1919, 1920, 1921. I think it's always worth remembering this was a world war they'd lost. It's not like losing a normal war. And there is, in the nature of World War One, an extraordinary national effort was required just to fight it at all. More had been at stake than, say, in the Boer War or the Crimean War. This was a war that tested a nation's ability to fight to the core, and they'd lost, which was a profound challenge to everything they thought they knew about their own country, about what it was to be a nation. It's a war that gives birth to the only political ideology invented in the 20th century, which is fascism. It's also the war that creates communism. This is a war that redraws the map of everything we think we know about how politics works in the world. So all of that I can understand. And it was a brutal, horrendous Armageddon moment. But what I could never understand is, why doesn't it fizzle out? 10 years later, 1929, think how long that period is. That's a long time to walk around being really angry about the Treaty of Versailles. And one of the conclusions I came to was because of men like Bruno, who absolutely made sure it wouldn't fizzle out as the preserve of the lunatic fringe and the beer sellers of Munich, who 5 years later, 6 years later, 7 years later, would become more and more marooned as just lone voices. So what I was interested in was to discover who this man was, but also what kind of Nazi career he had. Now, the actual circumstances by which I discovered what he'd done were, in 1992, as he died, I was in Berlin making a film for the BBC about the reconstruction of a big exhibition. In 1937, the Germans had pulled off the walls of all German art galleries, all modern art, abstract art, expressionist art, Jewish art, and they'd mounted this exhibition to parade what they considered the obscene aberration that was modern art. They called it degenerate art. And they mounted a touring exhibition that took this art for everyone to ridicule around the museums of Germany, culminating in Berlin. And before Tutankhamun in 1972 in London, it was the most visited exhibition in the history of art. So a lot of people asked the question, what was it all these Germans were doing parading through these art galleries? A lot of people would have been there to scoff. There's no shortage of people who revile modern art, then as now. But I suspect there were also a lot of people there having a look at what was about to go. An art gallery in Berlin had reconstructed this exhibition in 1992 as a way of commemorating it. Interestingly, there was only one painter alive who had had one of his works shown in this exhibition, who was a Jewish painter called Hans Weybusch, who turned out lived in London, so we went to interview him. He had a terrifyingly chilling story about what it was like to be in a circle of painters in Frankfurt in the mid-30s, and suddenly one of their circle took off his painter's apron, revealed himself in an SS uniform, and turned to them all and said, "You and you and you and you will never paint in Germany again." And luckily, Hans Weybusch could see the writing on the wall, and he got out. Quite a lot didn't. So I was in Berlin making a film about this exhibition, and it's a real what might have been. We went to visit my grandfather, and for the first time, I'd not really thought about any of this kind of history. It wasn't what I'd been interested in. I hadn't really given it much more thought than simply as someone who liked, I liked watching war films. I knew about it, but it wasn't a front-of-mind obsession of mine. And as we came to the flat, he had been taken by ambulance to hospital, and he died 3 weeks later. And I never had the conversation. And I look back now, because it was the one time I would have asked him, this exhibition, had you been there? And I remember asking my mother, as I discovered more about him, and I used to say to her, so what do you think would have happened if I'd actually challenged him? And she said, oh, half a bottle of brandy and he'd have just told you everything. He would have loved the chance to give his version of this story. He was not a shy or a bashful man. He was a very powerful personality, very rebarbative, very dogmatic, quite funny. He could hold a room. He was charismatic, loved the company of men, like a lot of Nazis, a great drinker, a great smoker, very gregarious. And I now realise, in retrospect, I'd had a number of conversations with him, which at the time, when I was 15 or 16, I hadn't quite understood. And it was only later on, after he died, that I realised he'd been playing with me. First of all, he always loved, to my mother's huge annoyance, plying me with cigars and drink. So as a 15-year-old, I was all rather in awe of this sort of thug of conspiratorial intimacy that he would create around us. And I remember him once saying, oh, you have to understand, Martin, all we wanted was an empire like your Mr. Churchill's. I'm thinking, like, your Mr. Churchill's. And he would just drop these things in my lap, and he enjoyed the discomfort they'd create. I remember him saying to me, you know what I enjoy most? I enjoy watching football. I enjoy watching Eurovision Song Contest. He was a big fan of that. And he'd say, but the thing I enjoy most is meeting my Kriegskameraden, my war buddies, And I thought, he's just said Krieg. He's the one who said war. I thought I was the one who was never supposed to use that word. And for any of you who are familiar with Germany, there's a tradition there. In a big old-fashioned pub, they have a thing called a Stammtisch. That's the table at the back, usually behind curtains, where local clubs, every Tuesday night, oh, I don't know, it's the bridge club. Every Wednesday night, it's the angling club. And they'll have a regular table. Well, in his case, the Stammtisch was a bunch of old SS Kriegskameraden who would meet and wassail each other, caress each other, with stories of old, interesting times. So when people ask me and said, do you think he was repentant? I say, he wasn't. He absolutely wasn't. I can see him in his eye. He's got a kind of demonic little glint in his eye, which is, you're too embarrassed to ask, but I've dropped this thing in your lap. Now how do you feel? And he had about him a thing that was, I think, quite emblematic of a particular generation of Germans, which was, I think his attitude to the whole thing was, well, we rolled the dice. We didn't win, but it was worth doing. Fortunes of war. So when I say he's unrepentant, he wasn't a neo-Nazi. He wasn't sitting in the corner of the room mumbling conspiracies of, you know, desperately trying to create the Fourth Reich. It's not the Odessa file. But I think he was somebody who was unrepentant. He had a circle of other old guys who had no problem whatever having survived the bloody thing, meeting and sharing old war stories. So that was the kind of man he was. But it was about a week or so after he died, and I remember saying to my mother, we got talking about it, because they'd been in Prague at the end of the war, and caught by the Red Army. And my mother, who was about seven at the time, has just some horrendous stories of what she saw. For any of you who know the history, Prague capitulates 3 days after the main capitulation of Europe. Patton and the American army is forbidden to enter. It's left to the Russians. And the Second Ukrainian Front go in. And Prague is an unusual place because it has been relatively unscathed during the war. And Beneš and the Czech government in exile in London, they have flown and they're coming up with the Russians through Slovakia into what is now the Czech Republic. And it was very, very clear that there was a sense of self-consciousness with the Czechs that they had perhaps, in Beneš's eyes, not done as much to resist as they might have. So what that created was, in a kind of blood-soaked spasm of about 3 or 4 days of nightmare, a kind of Czech uprising where they tried to do in 3 days what in Paris had happened over years. And it was blood-curdling stuff. And my mother, I remember having a memory of being in a cellar with all women and girls, and a number of the women were dragged out and branded with red-hot swastikas. Summary executions were completely the norm, and my own grandfather, what he'd done was, up to that point, he had persuaded a concierge in the block of flats they lived in to give him civilian clothes, because in that uniform, he'd have lasted 4 seconds. And he did that familiar thing they all did, which is, oh, it wasn't me, I had nothing to do with that, I was just a civilian. In his case, because he was a professional dentist, he had more credibility than others in explaining what it was he'd done. He also, by amazing luck, lucky man, more than one occasion, he didn't have the SS tattoo. Under the left arm was the blood group would be tattooed if you were in the SS. He hadn't had one. They'd missed it the day the guy had arrived. The other giveaway sign was a lot of SS people would burn it with cigarette burns, but all the Russians had to do was look under your arm and see a cigarette burn. Well, why would there be one except to cover up an SS mark? Despite that, 12 of them lined up on a pavement and a Czech partisan went up behind them, shooting them one by one in the back of the head. Bang, 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 got to two left. And a Russian intervened and said, enough bloodshed. He was down to two left. And to give you an idea of just how bloodthirsty it all was, if it took a Russian, a Red Army soldier, to say enough bloodshed, you can imagine. So it's an extraordinary kind of testament to the fact that he, time and time again, escaped by the skin of his teeth. We were talking about Prague after he died and sharing some memories with her. And I said, you know what, something has always bothered me. I've never understood what you were doing in Prague. You're 7 years old and your sister's nine. What earth are you doing? No soldier, no ordinary soldier takes their family with them. And she said, right. I said, he wasn't in the army, was he? And she went very quiet. I said, no, he was in the SS. And I was absolutely cut to the quick. I had not expected that answer. And I don't know why not. When I then did the research for this book, the signs were so clear and obvious. I mean, talk about an elephant in the living room. He'd made no attempt to hide it. And yet you still find yourself jumping to the conclusion it couldn't have been him. He was just an ordinary German caught up in it, conscripted. You know, it just could not be possible that somebody you were related to could have made the ultimate commitment to what still, quite rightly, remains one of the most worrying badges of evil the 20th century had to offer. I mean, I know they gave up black uniforms and turned them into field grey, but that black tunic and everything that that organisation stood for, quite rightly, is an appalling indictment of what a state thinks it has the right to do. So the next day, she then said to me, in a very garbled way, she said, yes, he was a Hauptsturmführer, but he wasn't involved in the camps. I thought, right, you seem very sure of that. I hope you're right. I had no idea what Hauptsturmführer was. I didn't know SS ranks, and I looked it up the next day in a book. It means a captain. So it's a junior officer. And I started to think, oh, well, that's not very senior. You know, a captain is hardly a senior policy-making officer. Until the next week, I went to see Schindler's List, which had just opened that year. I'm assuming, have people seen Schindler's List? Well, there's an extraordinary thing that happens in the middle of that. So the figure of Armand Gert, the SS commandant of Plaszow labour camp. When I first saw the film, it didn't mean anything to me. The second time, once I discovered all this, it did. He's introduced as Untersturmführer Armand Gert, second lieutenant, very junior. And I'm thinking, he's an Untersturmführer, second lieutenant, which is the most junior officer rank, and he's running a camp. Now, halfway through the film, if you've read Schindler's Ark, the Thomas Kennelly book, there is a particular paragraph where he describes Armand Gert's promotion. He's promoted two ranks in one go, very unusual, to Hauptsturmführer. And in the film, it isn't alluded to, but halfway through the film, his uniform changes from three pips and two lines. That's an Obersturmführer, that's a first lieutenant. The Hauptsturmführer has the same number of pips, but a third line. And I was watching it the week after my mother had told me this. And because I'd done a bit of research, suddenly, halfway through the film, Armand Gert, Ralph Fiennes' character, appears with the Hauptsturmführer thing on his collar, not just the three pips. And I suddenly thought, oh, my God. So a Hauptsturmführer is senior enough to run a camp. And then you discover that actually the rank of Hauptsturmführer was the most common rank you could have in the SS. Far more senior to being a Hauptmann, captain in the army, far more senior, far more powerful and influential. Mengele was a Hauptsturmführer. Klaus Barbie was. So any sense I had of, oh my God, at least his rank kind of makes it unlikely he would have been up to here in appalling atrocities, was blown away.
Thanks for listening. Why not follow our channel on Audioboo, where you can also subscribe to the RSS feed, or you can subscribe to us in iTunes. You can follow us on Twitter, where we're at @BParkPodcast, or join the Bletchley Park Facebook group. And of course, we must thank Audioboo, who make this podcast possible.